Well, I'm going to try not to sort of devolve into a coughing fit during my talk. It seems like it's that kind of day. So, but hopefully we'll get through this without any trouble. I'm going to talk to you about some work that I do in Mexico with land races of maize. And I'm really interested in places where there's these centers of crop diversity, where land races are grown, where they often support large numbers of families in this area. And I'm interested in their conservation, their evolution, and also their response to climate change. Now, land races, as many of you know, have a lot of important functions. I think in this session we've seen a lot about how important they can be as genetic resources for global agriculture. In these centers of diversity, though, they also tend to have very strong cultural significance, as is shown here by this mural in Mexico City by Diego Rivera of a man in front of his corn plant. They have often unique characteristics that can kind of dictate local uses of these plants. Under certain conditions, they can also be more productive than improved varieties. And when we think about in situ conservation of these varieties, so the conservation in farmers' fields, what that allows is often the evolution of these materials in response to novel challenges. Well, we have novel challenges ongoing all the time, but one of the major ones that's going to dominate many of our careers for the rest of our time is this issue of climate change. So as we see warming, what we're seeing also is a change in environments where these land races might be traditionally grown. So
this is a pointer?
Yes. Okay. So this is a study from Mexico in central Mexico. And if you just look here in this map here, the light blue area, that's what's considered like a highland agroecozone, so conditions, temperatures found in that area. If we look into the future and future extreme versions of climate change, you can see the shrinking of that area. So the diversity that's, say, here encompassed in highland areas is going to be facing these novel conditions, and one of the big questions is, what's that going to do to the diversity, what's that going to do to production in these areas? And we're already seeing globally reductions in crop production, and some of these areas might be especially prone to that. So in the work that I do, I often use existing environmental gradients to think about mimicking climate change. So if we think about a mountain and think about elevation, we know that temperature decreases as you go up in elevation. Depending on what side of the mountain you're on or what the specific conditions are, you might see higher or lower precipitation as you go up. Importantly, though, you're not seeing a change in photo period, often because these are kind of rapid transects that you're rising up in elevation. You may see changes in UV, though, depending on where you are. So, but the idea here is, if we can use these natural gradients, we know that plants along environmental gradients can be locally adapted to those conditions. And with climate change and the rising of temperatures, we are also seeing shifts in precipitation. And if you can find a gradient along an elevational gradient that helps you kind of mimic whatever changes you expect, we can glean some things from moving plants around here. So what we do is we perform reciprocal transplant experiments, where we take materials from different areas and then transplant them into reciprocally all these different areas. And we can discern both local adaptation, you know, this idea that plants from an area do best under the conditions where they're currently being grown, but also plastic responses. How do plants respond when they are moved to novel environments? And so what we're really doing is, when we think about climate change, it's sort of a space for time substitution, where we're saying, okay, if we move things in space, we move them down the mountain, where it's currently warmer, we might be mimicking what climate change will look like up the mountain X years from now, right? That's the idea. Now, we know that these land races, just like the wild relatives as well, continue evolving and have evolved over centuries in response to a lot of different selection pressures, not even centuries, millennia, environmental selection pressures, but also human-mediated selection pressures. So for instance, with maize, which is the system that I work in, if we can see patterns of selection across the globe, if you look at accessions from across the globe, where you see genetic variation, in this case, certain alleles at a flowering time locus found at higher latitudes and higher elevations, right? So we can see these this evidence of selection in the genome itself. Now, in terms of gene flow, we also know that gene flow can happen from hybridization, right? But there's also seed-mediated gene flow, and in these landrace systems, there's often a lot of seed exchange. So this is a nice graph from that same study in central Mexico that shows you the distance that populations or seed lots traveled when farmers were replacing their seed. So in this case, 90% of the seeds that farmers were growing were sourced within 10 kilometers of the community. But even more were sourced within the same altitude, so maybe not 10 kilometers away, but within 50 meters of elevation. So this may actually, this kind of seed sharing, although it does invite novel variation into a population, also could be reinforcing some of these the patterns in the adaptive diversity that we see from selection. So in my lab, generally, we don't just work on corn, but we're interested in these geographical patterns that exist for adaptive variation, so variation encoding traits that's important for yield, for fitness. So one of the things that we're asking here that I'm going to present about today is what responses do maize landraces from across an environmental gradient, across this elevational gradient, have to translocation, to being reciprocally planted in these different environments. And I'm going to show you some data today on productivity and fitness that will help us understand that. But we're also always trying to understand, when we do see differentiation between populations and local adaptation, you know, what's the underlying basis of that adaptation? Today I'm going to talk a bit about phenology, but we're also looking into physiological differences and other sorts of characteristics. And then we always want to be thinking about, well, how can this inform our understanding of how these crops may respond to climate change? And I'll mention my collaborator, Hugo Perales, who's down in Mexico and really important for making sure that we can do the work that we think up together. So I work in Chiapas. This is southern Mexico, so it's the southernmost state in Mexico. And it's a great place to ask these kinds of questions because there's a lot of altitudinal variation. So the darker it is, the higher the elevation. So there's a lot of nice elevational variation that is then paralleled by things like temperature variation as well. And we already knew going into this that there was the center of diversity had sort of geographic distributions of different types of maize that are grown. So these are three different land races of maize. Olotón is found typically more in highland elevations, say above, you know, 2,000 meters or so. Comiteco found more in midland reaches, and then Tuxpeño is dominant in the lowland and more closely related to a lot of the commercial varieties. So we knew that there was this geographic pattern, and in previous work we had some idea of local adaptation as well of these land races. But what we did for this study was we found a transect that went along this elevational gradient from 2,100 meters up down to 600 meters. And we made collections at each of these elevations. So in this area here, in this area here, in this area here, we collected 9 populations from each elevational range. And then created a reciprocal transplant experiment with these stars actually are where the common gardens actually were. And had a randomized complete block design at each of these gardens with all of our materials. And we saw pretty clear patterns of local adaptation. So some of these are just trends, but a lot of it is significant differences. We see, say, we're going to have a number of graphs like this, so let me just walk through what it is. Here on the x-axis we have our garden, where we did the common garden, where in the elevational range where we're actually planting the plants out. And then the colors are the different types of genetic material. So we had purple is commercial varieties that are grown in Chiapas. Red is lowland land races. Green is the midland land races. And blue is the highland land races, sort of on a temperature gradient there in terms of the colors. And then on the y-axis here, I have seed weight per emerged seedling. So this is basically a yield, but on a per plant basis. And what you can see is that we do see local adaptation. So when you just look at the land races, under lowland conditions, the lowland does best. Under midland conditions, there's a trend towards that midland doing best. And under highland conditions, again, the highland is the one that's producing best. And you can see that, you know, across these years. We're also seeing that warmer conditions for the highland and for the midland types does reduce fitness or reduce productivity. So if you just say, look at the Midland one taking down into the lowlands, look at the Highland one as it's going down in elevation, we're seeing these reductions in productivity. The commercial varieties are like the lowland varieties in their responses, but they're often a bit better, not surprisingly. But that's mostly, they sort of do the best of all of these land, do better than the land races, I should say, under the warmer conditions, not necessarily under highland conditions. Now we took this variable and we broke it apart down to survival to reproduction, because there were some plants that just didn't reproduce at all, and those that if they reproduce, produce seed. So I'm just going to show you the data from survival to reproduction, because it just gives us a sense of sort of the proportion of plants that can even produce anything. And what we see is that under these warmer conditions, and this was a real extreme year with a lot of drought here, but under these warmer conditions, generally, we see greater differentiation between our types, right? So the lowland and the commercial do very well in terms of every plant that's out there basically producing some kind of seed. But when you get up to a highland variety being under lowland conditions, you're only seeing about 30% of those plants even producing any seed at all, right? So that has a big effect on productivity, obviously. And there's this asymmetry of response, because as you get up into the highlands, you're not seeing any differentiation between these types. And we were interested in some of these flowering time traits, ASI, which is anthesis silking interval. Remember that corn has two flowering times, right? It's got the male tassel and the female silk, and there's the difference in that timing. And anthesis silking interval, the difference between those two timings, has been shown to be an important indicator of adaptation and stress response. So what we see is that the local types and the commercial varieties are the ones that seem to have the lowest ASIs in any of these locations. So again, here down in the lowlands, we see that the highland type has a much longer ASI than the lowland, and that the commercial variety has even a shorter ASI than those lowland varieties. And you see up in these highland conditions, we're seeing a trend in that same sort of direction, with the highland having the lowest ASI under its own conditions. And again, the commercial variety having a little bit of a shorter ASI than the lowland type. So this has been bred, throughout maize breeding, and there's, nice documentation of this and papers on that. So it's not surprising that commercial variety does a bit better in this regard than the lowland, but it's interesting that it doesn't necessarily do as well as some of these other local land races under the local land race zone conditions. Okay. So one of the things that we're going to move into, and this is sort of the initial part of this analysis, is really trying to understand the relationship between flowering time in these different environments and seed production metrics. So we just ran some quick correlations. We're going to go on to much more complicated regression analysis for thinking about selection on this trait under these different conditions, because just to throw out this idea, one of the ways that land races may well tolerate future climate change is actually evolving. So are there these traits that are going to be important for yield that are going to evolve over time? What sort of selection do they experience? So we're going to get there eventually, but we're not there quite yet. So for the plants that actually reproduced, like ignoring those ones that never survived to reproduce at this point, for those that actually did reproduce, what's the correlation between flowering time metrics and their productivity? So overall, we see earlier flowering both for the male and female, and shorter ASIs, shorter time between those two flowering dates, are correlated with higher seed number and also higher yields. But we wanted to kind of break that out and understand that more. So we're looking at this by garden and by the elevation of origin of the corn. So this holds true for all these traits for lowland and midland conditions. But once you get up into the highland conditions, all right, go ahead.
About 1 minute.
Oh, 1 minute, geez. Okay. Under highland conditions, the lowland land races are sensitive to flowering timing, right? But the highland land races are the ones that are more sensitive to ASI, the difference between the two. And commercial varieties seem to be sensitive to all of these metrics for yield, but not when you look at seeds. So there's some sort of compensation that they're actually going through. So just to summarize, the survival to reproduction, of our types was most distinct under these warm environments. And so we're thinking, okay, what does this mean for climate change? Are there going to be more and more plants that are not reproducing at all? And that's an interesting, important thing to be thinking about. And flowering time might be an important piece of that. We want to do logistic regression with the ability to survive to reproduce to kind of get a sense of, you know, of those that didn't survive to reproduce, was it partly because of their flowering time? And then I'll just go on to say that the ASI reflected adaptation, and that under highland conditions, I think this change in the relationship between the flowering time metrics and yield has something to do with the longer field season may sort of forgive some of these flowering time, different flowering time strategies under those that longer condition up in the highlands. So I want to acknowledge my collaborators and folks that have worked on the project and some funders, and probably don't have time for questions.
No time for questions.
Okay, but thank you very much.